Hey yo, and here we go. Another episode of We Talk Music is on the air and in your ear. And once again, I'm Martin, joined by the King of the Casters, the Chief Defender of the Faith, Mr. Brett Podcast. Brett, today's guest. Oh, boy, I'm looking forward to this one. Who have we got today?
Oh, wow. I mean, it's exciting. It's an honor for us. She is a member of, you know, one of the most important all-women bands of all time, the Go-Go's. She has a new autobiography, All I Ever Wanted. She is Kathy Valentine. Kathy, how are you?
I'm good. Hi, everyone.
I know that in the book you actually mentioned at one point that doing these type of pressers and phone calls can be exhausting. I hope we gave you a good experience here. A book like this only works when the author is completely honest, though. And how difficult is that? Is it cathartic? Is it frightening to be that transparent about your life?
Well, it was necessary. You know, my driving motivation wasn't to reveal my deepest, darkest secrets. It was to tell my story. And telling the story meant the peaks and the valleys and all of it. And it had to be honest. It wasn't a fluff piece. I'm not so famous that everything I think and do is going to be fascinating. So that means the real story is what I have to put out there. You know what I mean? So I felt like it was hard but necessary, and it was cathartic, and it was like therapy, but much more deep and intensive and a lot cheaper. and it also gave me a way to process. You know, there was things that I grieved. There's, I think it's in chapter, I believe it's chapter 6 or 3. I don't have them all memorized, but, you know, where I write about a rape that I grieved as I wrote it. And it was the first time in my life that I really, like, I mean, I cried for 3 days. So there was a lot of that, and letting go and healing as well. So it was I would pretty much recommend anybody to write a memoir, because, man, there's nothing like just kind of putting it all out there on the table, whether anyone else ever sees it or not, and just for yourself, and making some order out of the chaos and seeing the patterns that emerge. It's quite a process, and I think it's healthy.
And that was chapter 6 that occurred. I remember, you know, as it was happening, I'm going, I hope she realized she's being raped here. Like, I hope at the end of this, she will say, this is a rape, you know, and that this, to hold this person accountable for their actions, at least verbally within the book. Or I guess I listened to the audio book. So for me, that was how it came across. So,
yeah. Isn't it interesting, though? Like, for so much of my life, I was like, oh, it was, you know, I said, go, just do it. I put myself in that horrible situation, and it took like a long time. And I think it's one of the reasons I wrote about it. I think it's important for women to acknowledge and realize it's not their fault. You know, it's when you're a 14-year-old girl, you know, whether you got yourself in a bad situation or not, there's the guy was the accountable one. He's the one that did the wrong thing, not me.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
One of the things that as I read articles and stuff about the book as well, like, I noticed that you mentioned that when writing about your mother, that you wanted to write the truth, and that it wasn't about, you know, sparing anyone. It was about bringing out the truth. Now, did you receive any pressure, I guess, to spare anyone?
You mean about my mom, or
yeah.
She was the opposite. And it actually, you know, I have taken care of my mom my entire adult life. I mean, as the portrayal I portray of her, and I didn't want to demonize her. My mom is a very likable, warm, smart, funny woman, and she's not a demon. But, and I hope I didn't demonize her by writing about it, but it was so important to give the context of how I was raised and how it formed me. And what I write in the book is like, or in the, at some, I think in one of the descriptions, it says the way I was raised kind of informed the way I went after success, how I dealt with success, and how I dealt with failure. That, and so much of it was about feeling like I had to take care of myself and I had to be strong. I'm probably skirting around the question, which the thing is, I talked to her and told her, I'm going to write this. I'm going to tell this story. Are you okay with it? Because if she wasn't, I didn't want to hurt anybody. If she wasn't okay with it, I wouldn't. The story wasn't contingent on telling every, you know, negligent thing my mom did. That wasn't, but that was the story I felt like I wanted to tell because it had, it was a large part of what made me who I am. And she was so supportive and it gave me a lens to see her as a parent, a new lens, rather than some flake that just kind of left it up to me to take care of myself and then to take care of her. I started realizing that as a parent, there was a lot of things she didn't do well, but man, I felt loved. I always felt loved. I know that she's super proud of me and I felt supportive. When I wasn't happy at school, my mom found a way to get me out of that situation. When I wanted to be a musician and buy an electric guitar, my mom didn't laugh at me. Or I mean, I have musician friends that said that their parents weren't supportive at all. And like my dad wasn't. What if he'd been in my life? And what if he'd had sway over my life when he wrote me that letter that said, you know, I'm not going to help you with this. This isn't a good lifestyle. Besides, girls don't play guitar. What if he'd been like my dad living with me and said that? My whole life would have been different, you know? But instead I had a mom that said, okay, let's go buy you an electric guitar. You know, I saved up my own money when he wouldn't help me and she took me to buy it. And she was that process of realizing and seeing the good as well as the bad was very healing because I could let go of a lot of resentment.
I don't think you at all demonized her. Your mother comes across as somebody who's doing the best she can with what tools she has.
Good.
You know, that's really how, at least to me, that's how I saw it. And it was interesting because, I mean, you say it gave you a sense of empowerment to some degree. On the other hand, you also at one point mentioned you're in your early 20s and have the maturity of a 15-year-old. So, you know, I mean, like you say, it shaped you for better or worse. And I would say better because you are who you are now.
Yes, exactly. And you know, I don't know what it is. Some people seem to have adversity and less than ideal situations and they walk away as victims and it paints their entire approach to life. And I was the opposite. It just made, it's like I was determined to not be a victim of anything. And I don't know what that is, what if it's nature or character or what, but I'm grateful for all the things I didn't have because they gave me, like on the one hand, I think at my very core, I think I was and probably to some degree will always be this little girl who felt like she didn't matter enough to be taken care of, didn't matter enough for her dad to want her in his life, didn't matter enough for someone to look after me. And yet that feeling that way gave me this unbelievable fire to achieve and prove that I was of value. And I mean, I think I would have succeeded at anything I set out to do because it really drove me. I wanted to feel like I mattered and that I was worth caring about and that, you know, and not to get all heavy. I want to talk about some fun stuff too, because the book is longer, but you know, that's the thing that the message I want to get across, because that's something that, you know, I think a lot, if not most of us, have these things inside that kind of drive us and shape the way we deal with life.
It's interesting because one of the things that you actually say during the book is that your sobriety is that same type of attitude that led to your sobriety, to the drive to succeed. And you actually said it's your worst qualities that actually brought you to your sobriety to some degree. And I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, it was like the perfectionism and whatnot. Like it probably kept me sober for a while. Like when I wrote, all right, I'm going to be the best non-drinker ever. So damn how I can't drink, you know, it's just so stupid. Rather than I give up, I can't do it. I was like, had my pride and my all that. But it worked. Whatever, it worked.
It worked.
I mean,
works. You know what I always say? Things work until they stop working.
Yeah, that's.
You know?
Then you find some other way to work it.
You know, we all do things that we do because they are serving us or working for us to a degree, or else we wouldn't do it. And when it stops working, you either kind of grow up or you find some other thing that works for a while. But eventually, you've got, I think, you know, to be a fully realized human being, you kind of have to realize that you can't just use tools all the time to serve you, to avoid what you're trying to avoid. Anyway, let's talk about some fun stuff.
Yeah, well, for sure. And I mean, it's interesting because, of course, I like the personally, I'd love to do acid in Graceland, but you know, it's just like
Did I write this? I don't think I wrote it, but I was actually annoyed because I was a huge Elvis fan. I loved Elvis. And so I was like, I felt like, you know, I think we all did acid, and I felt like everyone was being disrespectful of the king and his home. So I just remember also, besides being really out of my tree, I was like annoyed that people weren't being respectful enough. So that's pretty funny.
It's just, you know, when you think about the things that happened to you as a band, and I think the things that really, you know, forged that, the band attitude, the sisterhood that you had. And when I think about that, like, can those things happen again?
With the Go-Go's?
Not with the Go-Go's, but like with a new band. Like, do you think the same kind of like hijinks and like just the overall like whole picture? It seems like life has just changed so much that those kind of things are not likely to happen anymore.
Oh no, being in a band it's like that. I mean, one of the bands I like, people a lot of times they say, like, what new bands do you like, or what women do you see doing this? And my favorite band I've come across in the last few years is the Beaches from Toronto. And I feel like they embody exactly what I was doing when I was their age. And that's one of the things I love about them. I just love seeing these musicians that are just having the time of their lives and doing it. And they have such joy around them, and humor and intellect. And they really remind me of the early Go-Go's. So yeah, I think when anytime you are in that situation where it's you in a small group, and a band really, really encompasses that feeling of being in a club. It's like you're in this exclusive club, and it's intoxicating and wonderful while it works.
Yeah. What do you, as the Go-Go's, do now? I mean, I know, of course, the tour got postponed, but, like, what do you do now to try to bring the fun and to be, you know, and to have fun together?
Well, we have a text chain. We text each other, usually kind of, you know, political memes and outrage and things like that. And we are actually always thinking up projects, and I talk on the phone. Belinda's in Thailand, so the time difference is pretty gnarly, but every now and then we figure out a way to get on a call together, and we share a wonderful bond. You know, I don't think I have a longer bond with anyone that's not my actual family, you know, and we've gone through so much. We've had terrible falling outs, just terrible ones. We've hurt each other and betrayed each other, and yet this bond between us is stronger than all of that. And it's kind of a very special thing in all of our lives now. So and when we do get together, it's like it's a chemical equation. It's the same outcome every time. We turn into these completely goofball, just laughing, cracking each other up. The things that we laughed about that happened, you know, 40 years ago, we can still laugh about the tour manager that got fired, or the time this happened, or it's really fun. It's a really fun thing.
How about the experience of the recording the audiobook? Were you very prepared for that, or was there times when that was, I don't know. How was that for you? I mean, I'm sure there was times you were reading it and went, oh, I wrote that?
Oh, my God. Well, I knew the book really well because I, besides the normal process of revisions and editing, I mean, I went through it with a fine-tooth comb constantly. I just wanted to be, I wanted it to be so well written, and I wanted it to be the best I could possibly, the best it could be. So I knew it really, really well, and I really wanted to do the audiobook. And at first, I didn't get an audiobook deal right away, and I was getting really worried that I was going to have to do, I was determined to do it if I had to do it myself. But when I partnered with Hachette, I was so, so excited because they are a wonderful company for audiobooks, Hachette Audio. And she, the producer booked, I think, 4 days for me to read it all. And it's exhausting. Oh my God. It's like you're literally just reading and making sure that your voice doesn't get too tight. And you have to keep a certain consistency. So I've never done anything like this in my life. And, but I did it in 2 days. Like I did it in half the time they had booked. And it was incredibly emotional. There were times that not only would I start crying, but the producer who was Skyping in from New York and the engineer who was in another room, I could hear us all crying. So it was very emotional at the appropriate times and, very intense, but I haven't listened to it. I have not listened to my audiobook, but I keep hearing from people because it has the soundtrack with it and other like underscores and parts of it. Like I'll talk about like practicing guitar till I could play like Chuck Berry, and I'll have that kind of underscoring like me like that, and like part of I talk about learning to play guitar or my first song. I found a recording of my very first band rehearsal, and that's kind of underlying parts of it. So I felt like it was really creative, which I just, anything that's creative and new and something I haven't done is interesting to me.
It's absolutely creative. The soundtrack, of course, people can go and listen to that on Spotify or any of the streaming services by itself. And next to Merle, I think, is my favorite of the songs. And the soundtracks, were these recorded specifically? Pardon me?
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say after the book. I didn't think of it until I finished the book. I didn't mean to cut you off. Let me finish your question.
No. I was just wondering if they were specifically created for the book and the audio book itself, and also, you know, where was it recorded, who was it recorded with, and that type of thing. Because it's a really well done. You know, it adds so much to the book.
Thank you. I'm so proud of it, and it's nice when I hear something like this, because I thought it would get a lot more attention than it's gotten. Maybe it's just too much to expect people to respond to more than one thing. But I thought it was such an innovative idea. I couldn't believe that more musicians didn't do that. I mean, you've got an entire book to inspire your soundtrack to. And I thought of it right as I was finishing the book. Number one, I was like, God, I can't wait. I miss music. I miss making music. I hope I still remember how to use all my Pro Tools gear. Oh my God. I don't wait to do it because, you know, you don't use it, you lose it. All those little tricks you learn, you have to like spend all that time remembering how to do stuff. So I couldn't wait to get back in the studio. And I just thought, I've got an entire book to inspire me lyrically. And the chapters already sounded like song titles, some of them. So I just kind of went in, and plus when you write a book and you turn it in, it's like in a whole year before it comes out. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do now? I've spent years writing this book, and now I'm just supposed to sit around and just shift gears and do something else. So it was a wonderful extension, but what I didn't have any idea of was how immensely exciting and fun it would be to be that creative without any boundaries of being in a band or making a record. Like even if you're making a record, you have a mind to like, oh, the songs have to be constructed in this way, and you want to have a verse, and you want to have a chorus, and you want to have a bridge, and you want to have a hook, and You want to have cool part. You know, you're thinking like within these confines with a soundtrack. It's like whatever I want. Like sometimes I would just pick a chapter. I'd go, okay, I'm going to do something for Liquid Forget. I think that's going to be good. And I had no, I would just go in. No, I did it all myself. With the exception on Next to Merle, I felt like it needed lap steel. So my friend came over and played lap steel. And then I worked with, this, composer, engineer, producer, multimedia artist in New York named Michael Rouse, who really kept things, helped me. He did all the mixing and then mixing. I recorded everything, but I would send him the files and he would mix and make sure that, like when I did a beat, like I would chop up my beats and make it, but he would make sure it sounded really current and fresh. He loves, you know, Chance the Rapper, Tyler the Creator, FKA Twigs, all this. Like he was just so well rounded in his musical knowledge that he helped with the sound somewhat. So it was just awesome. Sorry to go on about it, but nobody asked that much. And I
loved it. I'm so glad to have the opportunity to talk to you about it. I wish, you know, I'd like everybody to go check it out. If we were to throw a song on at the end here, what song from the soundtrack would you prefer for us to put on for you?
Well, you like Next to Merle, so play that one. And what I liked about Next to Merle and the whole thing was that each song I wanted to reflect the tone and the content of the chapter. And because that one, my dad's favorite artist is Merle Haggard, and I took the line from the chapter. When I'm inspired by a chapter, I don't just like read the text, I pull out relevant parts and do it in a lyrical way. So I kind of took the essence, and I think I took things from a little bit of surrounding chapters too, because I write about going on the road and going to my hometown and playing there and how weird it was. And I think that's actually from another chapter, but it fit the song. So there was just no rules. I guess that's what I'm saying. And you're in a band like my band in Austin, the Bluebonnets. It's a real kind of bluesy garage rock band. And, you know, there's certain songs that we sound good doing. And the Go-Go's, we have our limits. But with the soundtrack, I could do anything. Like Clubland, I was really inspired by like 70s Curtis Mayfield kind of the idea. But I could just use any influence for anything, anywhere. And it was incredibly freeing to just have your whole breadth of experience, not only what I love and like there's, you know, I got very Bowie-esque on Camouflage. Just anything I loved or was inspired by had a place, whereas in a band making a record or writing a song, you can't necessarily put everything that you've loved or been inspired by in the song.
Well, you're not thinking to yourself, I got to get this on the radio. And I think that's got to be a completely different mentality then.
Yes, exactly. And I'm not like, I don't have to go verse. I can just put a cool bass groove over an awesome beat and then lay on a guitar and then do some line from this chapter. And then, where is it? I had no idea. I had no idea. I'd never created like that. Like usually I'll write a song on the guitar and then I'll sit down and I'll find a beat and I'll just start layering it. With this, I would sit down at the console and the computer, and sometimes I would start with a guitar riff, sometimes I would start with a beat, sometimes I'd start, and I literally had no idea where it was going to go ever, and it was so fun.
Please go ahead, Brad. I was just wondering, just before we do, we have time for one more question each? I think we're right up against the clock here for our scheduled interview time. I mean, I'm enjoying it, so I would love to keep going if you can.
I hope I didn't get too long-winded.
No. If you have time, we can talk for a little longer. If you don't have time, then
we're just trying to be respectful of your time. Yeah,
I have time. I enjoy talking to you guys.
Thank you. Please go ahead, Brad.
Well, because the question that I wanted to ask is, do you think that this will inform the way that you create music going forward?
Absolutely. It changed. I mean, it gave me a lot of confidence. I have to say, I impressed myself, and that's such a wonderful thing as an artist, because often you don't, I mean this in not like a poor me, but often you don't have an audience. You know, sometimes you can make something and nobody hears it. So sometimes all you have is to impress yourself. And you have to get to a place where that's really freaking cool. Because sometimes that might be all you have. And man, I impressed myself with that soundtrack. Some of the bass playing, I didn't think I was capable of doing. I've only played bass in the Go-Go's and I do that really well. I'm very melodic and there's a lot of space for me to be the kind of bass player I am. But I've never played some of those kind of bass lines. Like even if it was something like, there's a very short thing at the end called Epilogue a Go-Go. And it's like super, like almost swing jazz. And I couldn't keep it up for a whole song. I made it 60 seconds, but I'm like, damn, this is like popping for like 60 seconds. And I'm doing keyboards, like these intricate keyboard chords and things I had no idea I could pull out. Musicality. So it gave me tons of confidence. In fact, my next big goal as a writer is to do a collection of literary short stories with a soundtrack. That's what I want to do next. There's just something that's so exciting and interesting about it. And I'll always enjoy getting my guitar and going out and rocking out on stage with a band. I'm always going to like that. But as a growing and developing artist, which a big part of my message is, I'm going to be 62 and you don't have to stop. You're not stuck being what you are. I'm sure not. This is like super exciting and thrilling to do, and I can't wait to do it again.
Well, and you can change your hairstyle one more time and put on a new, you know, and go for something different.
Why not? Yeah, I think there's this mythology that we're supposed to get old and be these people that can't figure out how to use our phones or understand, you know, the remote control, and just like not being able to keep up with the world and innovation and technology. And I think that's just a bunch of crap. Not only can you be looking into the future as you age, you can be changing along with it. And I like being someone that carries that message and shows that I do that as well.
Yeah, I wish you could tell my dad that. I spent so much time trying to show him how to use that phone.
It's like we don't. That's not who none of us want to be. I don't think any.
No,
I mean,
absolutely.
It's like and. It's almost like that you give up. You give up trying to understand. I mean, I'm trying to understand, you know, all kinds of like AI and crypto, and I'm trying to understand things that are really, I don't get it, but I'm not going to stop trying just because I'm 60, you know?
60's the new 20.
There you go.
I'm wondering, I don't get a chance to talk to many people that are, that were friends with Chrissy Amphlett, who from the Divinyls, who was one of my all-time favorite singers. I wonder if you can give me a really good story of her.
Well, I tell one in my book. I adored Chrissy. I always will. There's some things I didn't write in my book because there just would be not, they would be. She's not alive, and I can't ask her if she'd be okay with me sharing. So I had to err on that, you know, the side of that. But she was absolutely. It was to capture her. I think I did it in my book. She was just so, so sure of herself and not caring what she fit into. And just the voice alone is so crazy, but her intellect and her humor, I don't have any specific stories that I could share without asking her if it would be okay. But we had some wild stuff. I love the time that I wrote about where we just went out to dinner one night, and the next thing you know, we're on our way to Mexico. You know, I love that story.
What are some of your absolute favorite stories that you were just the most excited to write when you sat down to do this?
Well, some of the things I didn't know until I was writing it, and I tried to make sure that I didn't write it unless I was getting exactly what it felt like on the page. And so, sometimes I would read over something and I would go, this is well written. The sentences are fine. There's good use of metaphor. It's well written and it's not memoir. And you know, you've got to go deeper. You got to go deeper. And I would do it again because memoir is to succeed to me. It's really blood on the page and it's really I want that reader to go not only understand what I felt like, but I want them to feel it too, whether because I've done it so well that they can put themselves in that spot, or because I've tapped in to an experience that echoes what they're reading. And that's what I wanted to do. So a lot of it, I wouldn't write until I was able to get into that place. And so on the joyful things, writing about the recording of Beauty and the Beat was just phenomenal, because I don't think I had ever really sat in it and reflected what that felt like. You know, it just kind of, when you're living it and then it goes on and then the record's out and then you're on tour and all that. So a lot of the Go-Go stuff was wonderful to go back and really bring up what it felt like to be just on top of the world, 22 years old, in a hotel for 2 months. Who gets to stay in a hotel for 2 months when they're 22? City, making great music with their best friends and running out into this city that I've never been a part of or even known what the city's about. It was just a phenomenal experience. I was new in the band. I'd been in the band for like 6 months. And so we were still very much, I liken it as to a honeymoon. We were like kind of being adolescents for the first time together. And it was just exhilarating and wonderful and crazy and wild. And I wrote that I think all that got on the record as well. The songs are great, but I think that spirit and that energy got on the record too, and is part of the reason that's such a great debut. It's one of the top debut records ever. I think it's in the top 25. Anyway, so that, and gosh, recording the album, going to number one was awesome, but going on tour, being in that van, being on a tour bus, so much of it was just wonderful to write about. And, you know, meeting Keith Richards, I mean, that was like, he was my idol. I got to meet my idol and like actually hang out and talk to him. And I loved writing about that and what it was like, and just pretty much all of it. It was just like this great experience to make some order and make a story out of all these fragments of a life that were just kind of memories.
My favorite story personally is probably when Sting comes in, because you guys have surpassed the Police on the charts and you guys didn't know it.
Yes.
that was an excellent, excellent story.
It was so great. And it was like remembering that. I remembered it so clearly, but only when you're writing a book do you get a chance to really describe it in a literary way. So I think that's what was my favorite achievement about writing the book, was that in a literary way, I got to describe some remarkable moments without it being like, and then this happened, and then this happened. Or, you know what I mean? It was like, I think I succeeded in where my reader could really feel like they were there too.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's really noticeable about the book actually is a lot of these memoirs, it'll recreate exact conversations, I say that with quotation marks, of two people for, you know, two or three pages worth of exact conversation. And yours, I mean, you would have a little bit of quote of what you seem to remember from this person saying or this person saying, but you didn't do that. You didn't recreate exact conversations.
No, I mean, I'm an avid reader, and I mean, I think one of the things that kept me from writing for so long was like, if I can't write as well as the books I enjoy reading, I don't want to do it. So I understood, and I had taken enough creative writing classes that I know what's good, you know, and I had decades of trusting my judgment as a musician. I know I'm a good musician. I know what's good. I know what I should leave out. I know what's overplaying. I know what's in the way. I know when there should be, you know, I trust my judgment and my style as a creator. And I was able to move that over to my writing. And I knew when it was good, and I knew when it wasn't good enough. So that I had that, it was helpful. My songwriting experience is all about being a musician, what notes do you leave in? What do you take out? You know, what lines do you leave in? And I was able to use that as a writer too. And I knew that one of the main things is you don't, if you can possibly show without telling, that's what you do as a writer or a filmmaker or an artist. You want the person that's viewing or hearing or reading to get it without it being like kind of spelled out for them.
Mm-hmm. Was there a moment where you ever called somebody else in the band just to kind of help flesh out a memory of yours?
I was kind of on the outs with the band when I wrote it. So no, I was actually not in the band when I started the book, and it almost worried me. I thought it was the ugliest, worst time in our history. And, we'd had, you know, they had kicked me out and I had sued them to protect my financial interests that I had built for 35 years. So I was almost worried, like, how will I write about this part of my life without bitterness and anger? And I thought, well, I'll just deal with that when I get to it. And what I found was that the bond and the joy and the adventure was greater than that. It was a bigger thing than where we were at that time. So I didn't have that luxury of asking them. In the middle of the book, we patched things up. I got back in the band. But I had so much other ways to verify things through my Filofaxes, through all the press, through the journals. There was just a lot of ways to kind of verify things. I did do things with other people, you know, I would ask. And then when I asked my mom stuff, she couldn't remember anything, so she wasn't any help at all. But I'm kind of an authority now. When we did the Go-Go's documentary, like I sat down for my interview and they would say, like, you know, how did you feel when this happened or whatever? And I'd be, oh no, that isn't when that happened. And I'm such a, like, I researched when I would procrastinate, because that's a big problem with writers. It's like, you know, they call it the three P's. You have to deal with perfectionism, procrastination, and paralysis. And I wrestled with all of those numerous times. So, but I learned to use my procrastination spells as a productive, maybe that should be a fourth P. I got use it in a productive way. Like, okay, if you're not going to sit down and actually fill up the blank page with words, you better do something that's pushing this book forward. So I would research and gather my facts, you know, and I'm a researchaholic anyway. I kind of made sure everything was factually correct. Now, having said that, and it's a disclaimer in the book, it's incredible to me how you can put people in the same place at the same time and they will recall different things. That I learned was pretty amazing, how slippery the memory is. And there was a big discrepancy, actually, because Jane, I wrote that Jane left the band a few weeks before our last tour was coming to an end. And Jane says that she told us before the tour started that she was going to leave the band. So we have, that's a huge thing, Jane leaving the band. Yet we have two very different recollections of it. So I did try to, I thought ultimately I can't write it from her memory. I have to write it from mine. And I did try to verify with everybody else. And Belinda and Gina didn't remember. and Charlotte said she remembered it the way Jane did. So I thought, well, all I can do is do it the way I, and it ultimately it didn't change the outcome. She left the band. It's not like writing it with my memory is going to change what the result was. So that was one discrepancy that was fairly big.
I personally think there's a really strong argument to be made that the Go-Go's deserve to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. If you were to place that argument out there for people, how would you say it, or how would you place it?
Well, I would say that, number one, the facts are the facts. We did something that had never been done. We were the first all-female band to go to the top of the charts. We weren't the first all-female band. We weren't the first one to play instruments. we weren't the first ones to write songs, but we were the first ones that did all those things and succeeded at it. So I think we have a place in history that's worthy of note. I think the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I think any museum's job is to educate the people that go there. And I think that's, you know, as far as women's role in music, women have a huge role in music. I mean, I'm still learning about women that, like, you know, started big bands in the 30s and 40s, all female orchestras that I never heard about. But you now you can find out. And it's like, I think all that should be part of, you know, part of music history is what women did. And if you look at it in that context, the Go-Go's did something very extraordinary and significant. And I also think we inspired a lot of people to start bands. And that should be the criteria too. Were you groundbreaking? You know, you could make an argument, you know, people argue for every band that sold a bunch of records or every, and a lot of them, I don't want to name names, but, you know, what's so different about being, you know, a band that followed in the footsteps of Alice Cooper? You know, maybe Alice Cooper was the innovator and the people after that, you know, or what's so innovative about all the bands that followed after Deep Purple or Black Sabbath? You know, they were the innovators, right, of that kind of heavy sound of it. So it's like every band is supposed to be in there, every front person, but the Go-Go's did something really unique that hadn't been done before.
Another reason I personally think you can make the argument is it's not just the female bands, all female bands that you inspired, but when I look at the music that kind of broke in the late 90s, the pop punk sounds of bands like Good Charlotte and Sum 41 and Blink 182, Fall Out Boy. And these bands, I think that you can draw a direct lineage to the sound of the Go-Go's.
Thank you. I agree 100%. And you're like I think you're the only person that's ever said that. And that's exactly what I think. Even Green Day, you know, Billy Joe Armstrong has said that we were a huge influence. Kurt Cobain said he loved the Go-Go's. I mean, there was an impact there. And I do think that blend, I mean, that's what impressed me. I was a musician and had been a musician for a number of years. But when I joined the band, when I heard those songs, I thought, I've never heard a band blend punk and pop and surf and rock the way this band does. And it created this, like you say, this template that has been, when I hear like All the Small Things or any of these kind of, any of those bands you mentioned, I think it sounds like the Go-Go's. Me too.
Well, and it's so interesting because, I mean, like the Go-Go's music is, you know, it's part of our lexicon now with, I mean, when you hear those songs on the radio, you automatically, you're transported someplace else to when you first heard it, but also like, you know, it's the Go-Go's. And I mean, it's so awesome to think that, you know, you're a part of that and a part of having songs that will never die.
Yeah, and I think that's the other thing I would say for making us worthy of inclusion. There's not a lot of bands whose records came out in 1981 that stand up, you know, that you can play for a young teenager today or a young kid today, and they are dancing around and loving it and getting it, and it holds up. It's a classic, and it isn't the biggest catalog in the world, but man, is it stood the test of time.
Absolutely. People are still lining up to see you guys, you know, when the concerts resume. Trust me, the audience will be there.
Well, we have a tour booked this summer, so with things, you know, if things start getting, you know, 180 degree better than where they are now, hopefully we'll be able to show up for this tour.
Yeah, that would be great. I mean, I know we'd all love to be able to go out and see you, that's for sure.
I know, and I wish we could do more. I wish we were playing in Canada. I wish we were playing in other places. It's a little frustrating because, you know, everybody's in very different places, obviously, than they were when we were younger and didn't have as many responsibilities and homes and families and pets and other careers. So it's really difficult to come together and do anything.
There is that special bond between you and the fans, though. I know that, you know, that you feel it when you're on the stage, don't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I enjoy that so much. It's nothing I've ever taken for granted. It's nothing I've ever didn't feel so grateful for. I love performing for Go-Go's fans. I love looking out in the audience and seeing faces that I've seen over the years and little kids, you know, going crazy. It's amazing.
How did you decide when to end the book? Like, it feels like you probably could have just carried on even further, but I suppose at a certain point you just had to end it.
I felt like it was a classic great story arc where there was the person, the main character, ended up a very different person. That's a classic storytelling arc. You start out one way, you go through obstacles and triumphs, you lose everything. And it was a classic story arc that, if I went beyond that, would have gotten into life story autobiography territory, which I didn't feel like I wanted a memoir. I love Mary Carr, Augustine Burroughs, Cheryl Strayed, Tara Westover. I love memoirists where they take a part of their life. And some writers, they will write another memoir about another part of their life. And I was very cognizant that I had another very compelling story that I could write. And I'll probably do another memoir. But right now I want to work on another book, just so I'm interested in a career as a writer, and I need to lay a foundation, which isn't just like, oh, I can only write memoir. So I have to still build my foundation that I'm a writer of stories as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, it definitely sounds like it's kind of ignited a passion within you. And when you talk about, you know, the soundtrack and your passion for the soundtrack, I mean, I love it. Like, it's fabulous to listen to you talk about it, because I can tell how excited you are to try to build on that.
Yeah, I am, and it's a nice way to feel when you just like. And the pandemic has been good for me in that way. I feel like I've been Kathy Valentine this year for the first time in my career. I feel like most of my career, and a lot of this became apparent writing the book, because the book was Kathy Valentine. It was like, for the first time, I'm not in this safety net padding of a band where I'm like kind of insulated, because I'm not the lead singer, and I'm not the one taking the hits, and I'm not, you know, I don't know. It was kind of crazy and cool to go realize, like, oh my God, all my effort, all my energy, all my talent, all my creativity has gone into an entity, and it's never gone into just being me. And the book kind of changed that, and the pandemic helped bring more of it to fruition, because, you know, I'm just home with my daughter, and okay, what am I going to do now? I'm going to do something Kathy Valentine. I'm going to record a song. I'm going to make a video. I'm going to cover this tune. I've got some stuff on my YouTube that's been so fun. You know, I did a cover of Under My Thumb, where it's just me doing everything, and I made a video, and it's just been fun being Kathy Valentine for the first time in my entire career.
Well, you know, I hope that you continue to be creative and you write a new book, because it'll be another excuse for us to talk to you. and until then, though, we want to give you the opportunity here at the end to tell everybody where they can keep up with you and find you, you know, all your news, all the latest with yourselves, the Go-Go's. The book is, of course, available pretty much everywhere. So, you know, please, go ahead and plug everything.
Okay. Well, I have, I'm trying to build my YouTube, so find me on YouTube. I'm going to start doing more content, more and more content. In fact, I'm going to partner with somebody there to help me figure out what I can develop there. And I have a website that update as much as I should, but I will try to get on that, a blog on there where I can keep my writing public. I love Twitter. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram, a little bit less on Facebook, but I'm there. If that's your jam, you can find me. And What else? Oh, I did a cover of Beneath the Blue Sky with my daughter singing on it as well, that I'm doing a video for, and it's released as a single. That was a fan favorite off of the Go-Go's third album. So I thought, I'm going to redo that, and I'm going to revisit more Go-Go songs of mine that I get a chance to kind of reimagine without that band context, just for fun. So I'm super active. Please find me. I like engaging with people. I will, you know, except on busy days, I'll generally read or acknowledge any kind of engagement with fans, or, and you don't even have to be a fan, just like, whatever, let's hang out.
Well, awesome. Kathy, it's been so wonderful to talk to you, and you're so talented, and we do look forward to talking to you again and reading more from you. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you, and let me know where, find me on Twitter so I can post the, is this a podcast?
Yes,
that's right. I get mixed up. Yes, of course. I would love to share when you have it.
You bet. All right. Thanks a lot,
Kathy.
Thank
you so much.
All the best.
Yeah, you too. Bye.
All right, bye now.
Thank you.
On the road, heading for my hometown, that's in Texas, yeah. I'm going back where I'm from, rode in a van for 6 weeks straight. We got a tour bus, my work is played, it's one long escape for a troubled girl like me. I hit the show, couldn't find a groove, so an all-night bender with strangers will help me lose my blues. I saw my mama and I'm seeing my dad in Oklahoma. It's been 5 years since we were together, and now I'm all grown. But he just told me, I put your record right next to mine. S for Go-Go's, H is for Haggard. It's alphabetical, but still I know I'm better. I only asked for one thing in a letter. I was 16 for a guitar and an amp to help me find my way through the world. He said, except I'm crying in my bones, cause I was never daddy's girl, and now I've made him proud, cause he put my record next to mine.